So the recording has started. So, John, should I introduce you?
Of course.
Of course, right.
You know, I want a fancy introduction.
Well, I was going to write a song for the occasion, but I didn't get a chance to. John Kelly is the Elizabeth Spaulin Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Addiction Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He has the first endowed professorship in the field of addiction medicine at Harvard. He also runs a whole bunch of programs there, too many for me to name, and has published too many publications for me to talk about, and most recently was president of the Society of Addiction Psychology. And I will say that the time I was most impressed by John was when he couldn't make a meeting because he was addressing Parliament. So I thought that was, okay, he's outdone me. So, John, with no further ado.
Thank you, Mark.
Oh.
Thanks very much. I was kidding about the fancy introduction, but thank you for introducing me. And also, thank you for putting these on. I think it's just a great thing that you're doing. And it's nice that you're recording them and archiving them, too, so that we, you know, people can access them later. And thank you for having me. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being on the call. I hope this is somewhat interesting, if not informative and helpful to you in your research and practice. So I don't know if you have the slides in front of you or not. I will assume that you do, and I'm going to kind of go through them in that sequence. If you don't worry. Hopefully, you know, the storyline will be self. You know, illuminating as I go through. So Mark asked me to speak on this topic of mechanisms, and this is something actually I've done throughout my whole career, is look at mechanisms of behavior change. It's something I've been very interested in. I've been very interested in theories of behavior change. So how do people get well, and how do treatments work? You know, what are the mechanisms? What are our theoretical mechanisms? When we're treating patients, what are we assuming implicitly that needs to be changed, and what are we then trying to target to change the kinds of intermediate outcomes or mechanisms so that we can ultimately affect people's alcohol and drug use behavior, typically when we're talking about addiction. I've been interested in this for a long time, and thankfully, my interest kind of aligned with NIH emphasis in terms of what they've been funding. So today I'm going to talk about specifically mechanisms of behavior change to do with mostly AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and 12-step treatments. But I think the kinds of things that I'm talking about will have broader applicability, as I'll talk about, to other mutual help organizations, and I think the recovery process also more broadly. So in terms of an outline, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the evidence we have accumulated in the last 25 years pertaining to AA and 12-step treatment, and then talk about the mechanisms of behavior change and what they are, both theoretically and then what we've learned empirically and how those are similar or different towards, you know, in terms of what AA and 12-step treatment would say about how their intervention should work, and basically what we have found from the science. Then I'll talk about what the implications are of these findings and next steps. So I'll begin by talking just briefly for a few minutes about what we've learned about the overall effectiveness and efficacy. We've learned a lot in the last 25 years, and this has been stimulated really by a call from the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences, which back in 1990 called for more research on AA and 12-step treatment, citing really the evidence up to date, up until 1990, was viewed as methodologically poor, generally very constricted in terms of its measurement of 12-step participation. The measures themselves were not very well validated, psychometrically validated. There was high dropout rates, and generally there were contemporaneous correlational studies looking at AA participation and drinking. So it was unclear whether there were kind of causal effects to do with participation in AA. And what that did was it really stimulated a lot of, because it was coming from the Institute of Medicine, it stimulated a lot of interest from the field. And Barbara McCrady and Bill Miller, Bill Miller, of course, of motivational interviewing fame, convened a conference in New Mexico in 1992 and invited all the top researchers at the time in the alcohol field to talk about what we knew about AA and then what needed to be known. And they published a volume, which you can see here on this slide three, called Research in Alcoholics Anonymous, which really set the agenda for the research in the next 25 years. Since then, we've come a long way in terms of what we've learned, both in terms of the effects of AA and also treatments designed to stimulate involvement in groups like AA. There are now a number of empirically supported manualized interventions which have shown efficacy. We've also done, and really this is the focus of this talk, a ton of mediational mechanisms research on this topic of AA to try and understand how does AA confer a benefit and how does this do this, how does it do this over time. And we have a number of different, as I mentioned, a number of different types, different modalities of 12-step facilitation now, which are empirically supported. Now, when we look at the evidence base in terms of randomized controlled trials, what we see is that 12-step facilitation, which is a treatment, it's a professionally delivered treatment that aims to stimulate involvement in these community resources. So it's not AA per se, even though it's shown to be produce benefits superior oftentimes when it's compared to cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, to produce outcomes which are superior to other kinds of treatments. It's not AA, but when the studies have looked at why is it that 12-step facilitation is producing better outcomes, they find it is because of AA participation in the follow-up period. Also, what we found is that there's a causal, a true causal relationship, at least when we judge it by the most rigorous scientific standards that we have, both in terms of our criteria for inferring causality, which are known as the Bradford Hill criteria, as well as state-of-the-art statistical analyses. So when we subject it to those most rigorous and accepted scientific standards, what we find is that AA confers a causal benefit, it's not just a function of self-selection, but rather it does produce a causal benefit using the most rigorous accepted scientific standards and scientific analyses. The other thing that we've learned is to do with remission rates. When we can look at outcomes in different ways. We can look at the percent of days that someone is abstinent. We can look at longest periods of abstinence. We can look at intensity of drinking or days of intoxication. Another way we look at it is remission. So we have two specifiers in DSM-5, for example. We have early sustained remission, which will be 3 months of abstinence or 3 months with no symptoms, more accurately. And then you have full sustained remission, which is 12 months with no symptoms. And when we look at 12-step facilitation, what we see across multiple studies is that 12-step facilitation produces higher rates of continuous remission. In this example, in Project Match, for example, relative to CBT and MET, which were two of the individually delivered psychotherapies for alcohol dependence that were delivered in Project Match, 12-step facilitation produced 61% and 70% more cases of full sustained remission at 1 year compared to CBT and MET, and at 3 years, 50% more. Another thing that we've learned is the ability of treatments, and this is important, treatments like 12-step treatments that stimulate involvement in these freely available community resources to reduce healthcare costs. And this is important with healthcare reform as we're looking to produce a more efficient system of care. We do not have endless amounts of money to be able to devote to healthcare, unfortunately. We have limited resources, and we are looking for always looking for effective and efficient ways of treating high-volume, high-burden diseases like addiction. It seems that one of the things that can help is linking patients to these kinds of networks of support, recovery support in the community. And this is a study that was done in the VA that I'm talking about here on slide where I talk about the, if you're following along, the Affordable Care Act, right after that. This is a study where they compared treatment programs. These were residential treatment programs that did and did not systematically link patients with AA or NA after the inpatient phase. So there were five residential programs which did not systematically do that, and there were five residential programs which did systematically do that. And what they found when they looked at the outcomes at 1 and 2 years after treatment, they were interested in healthcare utilization across that two-year period, as well as clinical outcomes and related costs as well, healthcare costs. And what they found was that programs that systematically linked patients to AA and NA used fewer healthcare resources than patients coming from programs that were not systematically linked. And those patients tended to use more professional resources. There was no difference in the clinical and demographic characteristics across these different types of programs at baseline. And basically, the outcomes were similar, except that patients treated in 12-step facilitation programs where they linked patients with AA and NA were about one-third more likely to be continuously abstinent at 1 year and 2 years compared to patients coming from CBT programs. Otherwise, there was no difference in psychiatric outcomes or psychological symptoms or consequences. And there was a difference in healthcare use, as I mentioned, to the tune of about $8,000 more for patients coming from CBT programs relative to those coming from 12-step. So they had higher costs and not as good outcomes in terms of continuous abstinence. So what this suggests is that linking patients to these free community resources can actually produce higher rates of remission, full early remission, at a lower healthcare cost. So what are the mechanisms? If there seems to be a benefit, if we know that going to AA confers a causal benefit on people's outcomes, and we have treatments which are empirically supported that can actually successfully engage patients with these free community resources and thereby produce better outcomes, what's the mechanism through which that occurs? Because that would be good to know, because hopefully if we could find out what those mechanisms are over time, then we could start to develop potentially more potent and focused interventions that could target those specific mechanisms more succinctly. So when you look at 12-step theory, of course, it focuses, it's an ostensibly a spiritual organization. In fact, the organization itself says that recovery occurs through what it calls a spiritual awakening, which is as a result of the working through the 12-step programs. And this is obviously has created a lot of controversy in the field, of course, is it, including judgments by several Supreme Courts, state Supreme Courts around the country, which has judged AA technically to be a religion, and therefore people cannot be referred solely to groups like AA, which because of the ostensibly quasi-religious or religious focus. So does it work through religion or increasing spirituality, or is it through other kinds of mechanisms? And so this is, I think, something that's been very interesting, I've been very interested in. We did a systematic review back in 2009, and in that review, this was the slide here published, you can see the article from Addiction Research and Theory, where we conducted a systematic review of all the research that had been done up until that point on mechanisms of behavior change in AA. And what we found were three full mediational tests that have been conducted using the appropriate, fully temporarily lagged design with appropriate measures and controls and so on, and six partial tests. And from that, what was found when we looked at all the studies that had been done up until that point was that AA seemed to be working through some AA-specific factors and some common factors. And these common factors were things like boosting people's self-efficacy, their abstinence self-efficacy, in their ability to stay sober. In other words, their confidence in their ability, that going to AA boosted that confidence and thereby reduced their alcohol. It also was found to work by boosting motivation for abstinence on an ongoing basis, by boosting cognitive and behavioral coping skills, and also by facilitating changes in people's social networks such that going to AA helped people recover by helping them adopt a network or get involved with a network of who are supportive of recovery and abstinence, and dropping people who were out of their network who were heavy drinkers or drug users. There was some evidence for specific AA practices, such as AA beliefs and cognitions, and some for AA behaviors, as well as AA-specific processes, such as boosting prayer and meditation in terms of spirituality. But there really wasn't much support for AA-specific processes, including spirituality, up till that point. And since then, there's been a slew of studies, appropriately conducted mechanisms studies, which have supported some of AA's own theory about how it's supposed to confer benefit, and some have not. So there's been a study that we did using Project Match data. So what I'm going to talk about a lot today is actually a lot of Project Match data. And the reason why it's Project Match is because we have, in Project Match, a very large sample of 1,700 patients, more than 1,700 patients, with very good measures, with high follow-up rate, followed up over a year-long period at regular intervals. And so it makes for, it's very well suited to this kind of analysis where you want to look prospectively over time, unconfounded, the relationship between, you know, the intervention and then the mechanisms and then the ultimate outcome. So we have, we and others have conducted several studies looking at these mechanisms in Project Match, but other data sets too. So this first one here in alcoholism clinical experimental research, there was support found for spirituality as a mechanism. In this one by Amy Krentzman, she found the same thing. This was a different data set, again, using appropriate lagged designs. And Scott Tonigan and Barbara McCrady also found, again, a benefit through spirituality of AA on drinking. We have also found in another different sample that AA works, and AA and NA works by reducing craving. Studies have been done to look at anger. There are two other major central purported mechanisms in AA, in 12-step philosophy. One is that AA works by reducing anger and resentment. Another one is by reducing selfishness or self-centeredness. And two studies that were done to look at this did not find support for either of those. This one was done in the Journal of Alcohol and Drugs. We didn't find support for AA reducing anger, although it may increase coping with anger. We didn't measure that, but it didn't reduce anger symptoms per se. In terms of selfishness, Scott Tonigan and colleagues have conducted a study where they looked at the way that AA worked, did not find that it worked through reducing selfishness in this study. We have found some support that AA works by reducing depression symptoms, and strong support for AA working through reducing or changing people's social networks. And that's the study on AA Mobilizing Adaptive Social Network Changes, published in Drug and Alcohol Dependence. There's also some evidence on impulsivity. So one of the other ways that AA has been shown to work is by reducing impulsivity, particularly among young people. So one of the issues, of course, is when you look at studies which look at a single explanatory mediator, is that, and you find that all of these different studies with different mediators are supporting, supported, you don't really know, well, how is it really working? Is it working through spirituality, or is it through reducing impulsivity or reducing craving or changing social networks? Which is it? And which is the most important, right? Because we know that interventions typically confer benefits and work through multiple mechanisms simultaneously. And so what we did in the next three studies I'm going to talk about is we conducted studies where we actually looked at multiple mediators at the same time. So we were able, in other words, what we call to increase the specification of the models that were tested. And that means to more to flesh out the theory about how interventions confer benefit. And so in this case, what we did was we put six mediators. We had six different potential mechanisms which had empirical support in terms of the way the AA conferred benefit. And you can see this in this complicated diagram. It looks complicated with all the boxes and the arrows, if you're following along.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it looks fairly complicated, but conceptually, really, it's quite simple, that what you're looking at the top of this slide is AA attendance there, predicting out. AA attendance at 3 months, in the first 3 months, predicting alcohol outcomes a year later. And then we're looking at mediators in the middle, at a middle time point. So it's temporally discrete in terms of the temporal lag. So the idea here is that AA produces changes in these mediators, and these mediators produce changes in their drinking outcome. And then on the left, you can see all the variables that were controlled for in the model. So we want to control, obviously, for the baseline level of those mediators, you know, the level they came into treatment with. We want to make sure we take those into account, as well as all the other variables that could potentially influence the relationship between AA and outcome and the mediators. So we control for all of those. So we wanted to look just pure and simply at the effect of AA on outcome and its relationship through these mediators. And we ran three separate sets of analyses and published three different papers on this topic. And I find this to be fascinating, actually, doing these multiple mediation studies and also what are called moderated multiple mediation studies. And I'll explain what that is here. So as I mentioned, you know, we want to find out, well, how does AA work? Is it just through spirituality or just through boosting self-efficacy? Or is it through multiple mechanisms simultaneously? And in this slide, you can see these four different pie charts with aftercare at the top and outpatient at the bottom. And then on the left-hand column, you see that PDA. That's the outcome. So that's percent days abstinent on the left-hand column. And on the right-hand column is another outcome, drinking outcome, called drinks per drinking day. So we have two different outcomes here represented on the left and right. And then above and below, you see aftercare and outpatient. And that's different levels of severity. When you look at the aftercare sample in this Project Match data set had inpatient treatment prior to entering the study. So they were more severe on several measures, indices of severity, compared to the outpatients who did not have residential treatment prior to coming into the study, recruited from the community into the study, and then were randomized to receive one of those three treatments, 12-step facilitation, cognitive behavioral therapy, or motivational enhancement therapy. They were very heavy drinkers, about roughly anywhere between 14 and 22 drinks a day when they came into the study. So they were heavy, very heavy drinking, mostly alcohol-dependent patients. And you can see here in the colors in this slide is, and each color represents one of those six different mediators. And you can see they vary to varying degrees in terms of their size and what proportion of the pie they take up. If we look over on the left-hand column, looking at the abstinence, we can see some similarities and some differences between the more severe patients at the top and the less severe patients at the bottom. You can see that, for example, the purple segment, which is social self-efficacy. So this is the ability of AA to boost people's confidence in their ability to cope with high-risk social situations where alcohol is present. So this was found to be a significant mediator. In other words, AA works by boosting people's confidence in their ability to cope with high-risk drinking social situations. You can see also the orange and the light blue segments are strongly represented, both in the top and bottom pies, in the more severe and less severe. But in the less severe patients, there's a much higher, bigger proportion of the pie that's explained by these changes in the social network. So AA was shown to work for the less severe patients by boosting their social network for recovery and by helping them to drop heavy drinkers from their social network. It was also true among the more severe patients, but to a lesser degree. What was different, as you know, in the top more severe patients, is spirituality was a significant mediator, accounting for 23% of the direct effect of AA on alcohol. But it was not a mediator for the less severe patients. So it's interesting that there are these differences depending on severity. And again, if you look on the right-hand side, we see a similar picture where spirituality affects the more severe patients, but wasn't a significant mediator among the less severe patients. And among the outpatients, you see much stronger effects for these social factors, whereas for the more severe patients, you see a more variety of different mechanisms through which AA is helping people to reduce their drinking. So another follow-up study we did was to look at men and women. And the question here is, do men and women differ in the ways that AA helps them recover? And you on the left-hand on the top row, you see women. On the bottom, you see men. And on the left-hand side, again, we have days abstinent. On the right-hand side, we have intensity of drinking, drinks per drinking day. So here we find some even bigger differences and interesting differences. What we found overall was that men and women benefited equally from AA participation, but the ways that they benefited differed. If you look over on the left-hand side, you can see the abstinent column. This is percent days abstinent with women at the top and men at the bottom. And you see some similarities, but you can see obviously in the bottom segment, particularly with social self-efficacy, double the effect there for men than for women. So, in other words, AA helped men reduce or increase their abstinent days by boosting their confidence to cope with high-risk drinking situations, social drinking situations. And it was true for women, too, is also significant, but only about half of the magnitude. Interesting as well is that among women, AA participation boosted their confidence in their ability to cope with negative affect without drinking, whereas for men, that was not a mediator at all. So for women, it seems that AA was helping women differently than men. Men seem to be benefiting from AA participation via its ability to help them cope with social situations without drinking. For women, it was more to do with coping with negative affect without drinking. On the right-hand side of this slide, you can see that even more starkly exemplified if you look at the top and the bottom, where women at the top, men at the bottom. Again, if you look at the blue segment, you can see that 33% of the effect of AA on drinks per drinking day for women was explained by AA's ability to help them cope with negative affect without drinking, But in the bottom pie with men, that was not a factor at all in terms of helping them reduce their drinking. Whereas for men, look at the purple segment for men. 39% of the effect on reducing intensity of drinking for men, you'd say preventing relapse for men, was through its ability to help them social situations. For women, that was not a factor at all. You can see it's not even, there's a tiny little sliver of the purple up there for women. So for women, it was much more important, was coping with negative affect, which AA helped them do to reduce their drinking, whereas for men, it was to do with their social situations. We also did this looking at age. So here, in this analysis, we looked at young adults and older adults. So we're slicing the pie again a little differently. But again, PDA on the left, days abstinent, and drinks per drinking day on the right. Again, we see differences across this demographic of age, with AA helping younger adults differently than older adults. So you can see the gray segment on the left, the largest proportion, both for days abstinent and drinks per drinking day, was via AA help young adults, via helping them to drop heavy drinkers from their social network. This was also true for older adults, but not to the same degree. And it also helped young adults more by helping them cope with higher-risk social situations without drinking relative to older adults. So in terms of the conclusions about these multiple mediator studies and what we call moderated multiple mediator studies, so these are looking at mechanisms of behavior change, multiple mechanisms through which an intervention works, in this case AA, but also whether those mechanisms differ depending on some other variable, so such as someone's age, their gender, or their addiction severity. What we found was that with these six mediators, which had been empirically supported prior to this multiple mediation analysis, we were able to explain about half of the direct effect of AA on drinking outcome. Of note, also, was that the same, ostensibly the same intervention produces benefits that differ in their nature and magnitude between more severely alcohol addicted and less severely alcohol addicted individuals, as well as men and women, and as well as young and old adults. And these differences may reflect different needs based on the recovery challenges related to different symptom profiles, the degree of subjective suffering and perceived severity, as well as their life stage-based recovery context and gender-based social roles and drinking context. So what we find is very similar to what has been found in psychotherapy research. What we're finding in AA is that even though there is a theory that is supposed to be the way that the intervention works, in which, in this case, it is through spirituality in the case of AA, in other interventions it may be through boosting people's coping skills, such as in CBT, for example. But what we find, in fact, that the way that AA works is through multiple mechanisms simultaneously, or another way of saying that is that the way AA helps people recover is by people picking and choosing different aspects of AA which have the most salience and relevance to them at that particular phase of their recovery. So for women, for example, they are choosing to use resources within AA to help them cope with their negative affect and depression symptoms. For men, they are using AA to cope with the most salient risks that they are facing, which appear to be these social risks, where drinking is present. This could be sports events, other kinds of male social events at this particular phase of their life course and their recovery. And so there's a number of things on offer in AA, like in other interventions that are available to people that they can pick and choose to help them. And I think, you know, when we look at the, you know, the implications of this, when you look at the slide here on empirically supported mechanisms of behavior change, this is the one with the colorful bubbles. These are currently the empirically supported mechanisms of behavior change through which AA confers benefit. So we have social networks, boosting abstinence social self-efficacy, boosting people's negative affect abstinence self-efficacy, their coping skills, craving, reducing craving and impulsivity, enhancing their motivation for recovery over time, and by boosting spirituality. I haven't shown you all of these studies in detail here just because we don't have time to go through everything, but I wanted to spend a bit more time on those multiple mechanism studies because I think those are the most interesting and really where we need to be ideally to understand how interventions work. I think what's interesting from a 12-step standpoint or a 12-step philosophy standpoint is that the mechanisms through which AA confers benefit has a closer fit with more pragmatic social, cognitive, and behavioral experiences documented by its members in its later publications when the organization numbered more than 1 million people, about half of whom had 5 or more years of sober experience, than with the first text, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was which purportedly espoused a spiritual mechanism, but it was based on less than 100 cases, most of very severe addiction severity, very high addiction severity, and most with very short lengths of sobriety. I think what's interesting is that when we look at severity, we do see in these multiple mechanism studies, we do see that spirituality plays a role, but only for the more severe addiction cases. And we see a much broader number of different mechanisms, particularly the social, cognitive, and affective mechanisms operating for the rest of the folks who are less severe. And when you think about it, it kind of fits actually with the case examples on which the 12-step program and the big book is based, because that was in fact based on a very severe case set of individuals with high addiction severity. So probably that emphasis on the spiritual aspects was more true to form in terms of what their own experiences were at the time when they wrote the 12 steps and the book than what was to come later with a much broader membership with varying degrees of pathology and addiction severity and related impairments. So how might then participation in groups like AA produce reduced relapse risk over time, given what we understand now empirically from these multiple mechanism studies? When we look at precursors to relapse, we know that there are three major precursors. Cues, these are conditioned cues, associative learning, classical condition, people, places, and things which become strongly associated with alcohol use or other drug use. Stresses, stress-induced relapse is another one. This can be both negative stress and positive stress. And then priming doses of a drug, having a little bit of the drug, can increase the risk of relapse as well. And what we find is that AA may help reduce these risk of relapse by helping people to change their social network. What it does is that it reduces exposure to triggers in the environment, so alcohol and drug cues in the environment, by associating with other people who are living a lifestyle that is not does not involve exposure to those cues. It also seems to reduce that particular pathway via boosting people's confidence in their ability to cope with situations, particularly for men, for example, in social situations when they're exposed to cues. In terms of stress, AA helps reduce relapse risk by boosting coping skills and by boosting negative affect, abstinence, self-efficacy. And this is particularly true for women. And the spiritual framework of AA also may help provide a compassionate framework that can save self-forgiveness and other ways that it can spirituality can work to reframe stress from a negative to an opportunity to for growth. And another way, I think, that AA in particular works and 12-step treatment, as we've seen with the multiple studies now, which show higher rates of continuous abstinence for people involved in AA or receiving 12-step treatment relative to those that do not, is that the strong emphasis on abstinence tends to produce higher rates of continuous abstinence. And that then but thereby reduces any exposure that can kindle craving and increase the risk of relapse. So what we find when we look overall at the science that's been produced in the last 25 years and we look at the clinical implications is that a good idea to facilitate linkage to mutual help groups. We have right now the only empirically supported mutual help organization is AA. We have some evidence for NA, but we are trying to enhance that evidence base by studying other groups like Smart Recovery, which and Secular Organization for Sobriety and other ones to see if these same kinds of results can be produced in those organizations. I would argue that we probably will find that if people attend these other organizations, we will find similar kinds of benefits, but we haven't got the data yet. I think what we can say is that systematic linkage to groups like AA boosts outcomes relative to treatments that do not systematically link patients to groups like AA. We also have learned that patients with high network support for drinking, so if your social network is comprised of people who are heavy drinkers, in particular, you're going to benefit from a treatment that links you to groups like AA because it is going to help change your social network and boost your abstinence self-efficacy to cope with high-risk social situations. What we've also learned is that spirituality, even though 12-step organizations are ostensibly spiritual or even quasi-religious and have these religious overtones, participation, That spiritual barrier may not need be a barrier to participation. Most of the effects are, in fact, for most people, produced by these social, cognitive, and affective changes which can come about as a function of participation. And I think when we look more broadly about what we can learn from this kind of research across the field of recovery, and remember, we're dealing with an illness which tends to at least for quite a while when people start to seek treatment initially, be susceptible to relapse until people get into full sustained remission. And it can take several years for that to happen. So we are looking for ongoing kinds of interventions that can, ideally low cost, that can support people's behavior change over time. What we've learned is that men tend to use AA more or benefit from AA more by its ability to boost their abstinence, social abstinence self-efficacy. And for women, it tends to help them more by boosting their ability to cope with negative affect. So treatments designed to emphasize the relative relapse risk associated with these specific biobehavioral life stage context realities may improve outcomes. In other words, if we focus maybe more, and this is an empirical question, on negative affect, focusing on more to do more aspects of the negative affect that women appear to be facing in early recovery than men. And by the way, negative affect was the strongest predictor of relapse for women, and it was not a predictor at all for men. And abstinence social self-efficacy was the strongest predictor of relapse for men, and it was not a predictor at all for women. So that could not be more different. And so it suggests that men and women may benefit from relatively different emphases that attend to the kinds of life stage relapse risks which are most salient for them at that particular stage of recovery and life stage. So what are the next steps in this line of research? Well, we know we've explained about roughly half of the direct effect of AA in this case. The other half, we're not clear on exactly what's happening. We are actually about to launch, hopefully next year, another study where we're going to look at impulsivity in more detail, as well as more intricate social network effects to look at how changes in the social network change other things. But there are a slew of other kinds of mechanisms that we don't know about right now that maybe that are explaining the effect of AA on people's behavior change processes over time. Okay, so that's about all I have. Hopefully we'll have time for questions.
Hi, this is Mark. John, that was terrific. I really appreciate it. I have a sort of a marginally related question, which is, lately I've had several people throw the figure of 5% out at me, which is allegedly the success rates, as they say, of AA. I don't know where this number comes from. I saw it in Lance Dodis's book. Could you speak to that at all, as to where that comes from and how they get to that measure, or is that something out of your purview?
Oh, I don't know. I've heard numbers like that, 2% or, 5%. I don't know. If someone could send me the article on which that is based, I could take a look and appraise it a little bit better. And what is meant by, we need the operational definitions of what is meant by success, et cetera. I just don't know, actually, where those come from. But I would love to see the articles on which those numbers are based, just so, we could take a look at and see exactly if that's true and what success, quote-unquote success, means.
And well, how they're following people.
It's a Dan.
That? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Susan Kelly, I just said, and how they're following people in recovery to decide that there are only 5 or 3 or 2%. I would find that interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think, when we look at the clinical studies that have, as I mentioned, we see, and it depends on what you're comparing it to, of course. And when you compare it to, when you compare treatments, as I mentioned, that systematically link patients with groups like AA, they tend to have better outcomes, particularly full sustained remission and remission outcomes, as well as continuous outcomes. And that benefit is explained by AA participation. And AA participation, in turn, mobilizes the same kinds of mechanisms that are mobilized by formal treatment. So we know that going to AA boosts cognitive behavioral coping, it boosts abstinence self-efficacy, it reduces depression, it increases psychological well-being, it reduces craving and impulsivity. So it reduces and changes, and it changes people's social networks. So it makes these changes, facilitates these changes over the long term, but in the communities in which people live for free. So that's kind of the benefit that we have from AA, but I think all mutual health groups do this, and it's just that we don't have the evidence. We have the most evidence for AA just because it is so big, and we're able to study it because most people are referred there.
This is
John,
Ann
this
Fletcher.
Is Tom Horvath. John, this is Tom Horvath. So you're hypothesizing that regardless of how these mutual help groups present themselves, that perhaps when the evidence is gathered, we'll see very similar mechanisms of change across all of them.
Yes. That was where I would put my money. In the same mechanisms across different professional treatments that are mobilized, these broad stroke coping, self-efficacy, are mobilized by ostensibly, philosophically, discrete, distinct treatments tend to mobilize the same kinds of processes. I think we'll see the same kinds of things operating across smart recovery, AA, LifeRing, and other groups.
And this is Susan Kelly. I think that, and one of the things that you mentioned was with continuous attendance getting continuous support from these groups, like continuing to go to Smart Recovery meetings or continuing to go to 12-step meetings. Was that part of what you were saying also?
Well, there is evidence that, you know, people who go and stay in some kind of continuing care tend to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And there is evidence to support that. It's unclear, you know, and it's different for different people. So some mm-hmm. people become engaged in these resources and then disengage but stay sober. Other people need it more and they'll keep on going. So it's unclear exactly what differentiates those folks, but in general, on average, we would see that people who are engaged in some kind of recovery support, continuing care service over the long term tends to do better than people who don't.
Thank you.
John?
Yeah.
This is Ann Fletcher. It was my understanding that 5% success rate or 95% failure rate figure came from AA's own literature many years ago when they used to keep some kind of statistics, but whatever the case, I don't think it's accurate. But Scott Tonagan told me when I was writing Inside Rehab, he was reviewing the scientific literature, and the figure that he gave me just from reviewing the literature was 7 to 8 out of 10 people. Wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong numbers. Between 55% and 80% of alcoholics, his word, encouraged to attend AA while in treatment will stop attending AA in less than a year. So that was the figure that I used in my book. So anyway, that's just some numbers that are out there. A comment that I wanted to make is that, you know, do you have any sense of, this is a question and then I'll follow up by a comment, of how many 12-step programs, or programs in general, treatment facilities, are truly using 12-step facilitation? In doing my research for the book, I did not find any 12-step-based residential programs that were using 12-step facilitation. And generally, the experience of clients is that it is imposed upon them without a choice. It's not true facilitation. And that's where things kind of fall down. And they describe that experience over and over again, and you know the line about how they're blamed for the failure when it doesn't work.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, when you say 12-step facilitation, are you referring to the manualized outpatient manuals that have been tested?
Well, yeah, or even facilitation. It's more, you know, if you don't do this and you don't do it this way and you don't accept that this is a disease, getting into the disease model, then, you know, it's more that it's imposed as opposed to a facilitation, an introduction to AA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm sure there's a whole mixed bag of stuff that goes on out in these treatment facilities. You know, who knows exactly what goes on, but I guess it would be treatments will be delivered with varying degrees of recommendation versus you got to do this.
I guess it's so important that treatment facilities understand the clients do better when they're given choices. And they, you know, I think it's better than it was, but that message still doesn't seem to be getting fully across.
From my experience in several treatment facilities, they really stress multiple avenues of recovery. Some recovery houses, residential houses, require people to go to AA meetings.
Yes.
Or to go to or to find social supports. I've found I have not found people really having it shoved down their throats.
I think it depends on where you're located.
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. And the person's perspective, whether it's being shut down their throat or not.
But I think coercion is a separate issue from the facilitation. I think
absolutely. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah. And also, I think that 12-step facilitation, as it's in the manual, is not what's practiced in the real world.
Yeah, that's the point.
Well, but in the same way as Bill Miller talks about the spirit of motivational interviewing rather than the manual.
Yes, yes.
So.
But I think also it's important. I mean, we can, for example, you know, because clinicians prescribe things based on the evidence. And there was a study. There was a study done by Kimberly Wurlitzer, and I think Anne, I think you know this study. It was a randomized controlled trial where she actually compared two different types of 12-step facilitation, and compared that to CBT alone. One was one type of the 12-step facilitation was a more motivational enhancement 12-step facilitation, whereby the patient was asked, "What do you think about going to AA? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it would be helpful?" So one third of the patients got that intervention, and the other third got, "I'd like you to go to AA. I'd like you to try three meetings this week and come back and tell me your experience, and we'll talk about it next session." So one was more client-centered, the other one was prescriptive and directive, and those were both compared to CBT alone. And what she found was that the prescriptive approach was what made the difference. But that is, you know, that's different from you've got to go, but it's rather I would recommend you go or I'd like you to go in terms of prescribing it as opposed to, you know, I guess, you know, in terms of how you say it. But one was more prescriptive and the other one was more client-centered. And when when people were said, what do you think, they went substantially less than people who were prescribed it.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I had not heard about that.
Yeah. And they had better outcomes. They had about 10 to 20% better outcomes as well as getting more involved. And when she looked at the reason why they had better outcomes, it was because they were more involved in AA.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, that is an interesting, it was a very well done study. But, you know, I mean, what that says to me is that people need a bit of a nudge.
Mm-hmm.
We all need a little bit of a nudge to cross that threshold, whether that's into treatment or into a recovery support service, and prescribing it. And there's been several other studies as well with 12-step facilitation where it makes a difference who's prescribing it. There was a study, a couple of studies. One was done in London, actually, in England, where it was done on an inpatient unit, and three types of conditions in this experimental study where patients were randomly assigned to receive a referral from a doctor versus a referral from a peer versus no referral to 12-step. And what they found was that overall, the peer was better about getting people to meetings, but the physician was better at people who'd never been. Much, much better. So if you'd never been to AA or NA before, the doctor was like five times better at getting you to go than the peer. So that authority figure, so prescribing something, in other words, that is based in evidence, can help people try something that they wouldn't normally try.
This is Anne Wallace, and I want to say that at one of the Harvard Treating the Addictions, Nora Voco presented, and she put out the rate of recovery as at one point having been 1 out of 10. Now, this would be the entire population of known alcohol abusers, not just people who had treatment and people who hadn't, and that over time that has improved to 3 out of 10. So the rate isn't great, and at least from that report.
So this is Susan Kelly. Is that the rate of people recovering from alcoholism with or without 12-step programs or help, or this is?
Now, my understanding was that it was either naturalistic or intervention recovery.
So the overall recovery rate was pegged at 2 or 3% or something.
I'm not sure where she's getting those numbers from, because they don't correspond with many of the dozens of trials, long-term trials, or even the latest epidemiological surveys, which show 50 to 60% remission, full sustained remission. So when you look, for example, in the latest NESARC, which is a nationally representative data sample, NESARC 3, using DSM-5 criteria, when you look there, and we just did an article on this on recoveryanswers.org, the Recovery Research Institute, what you find is that drug use disorder remission, full sustained remission, is about 62%. I think alcohol use disorder remission is about 51%. So of those who meet lifetime criteria, the majority actually achieve full sustained remission. Now, not what when she says recovery, I don't know what she means, if she's talking full sustained remission or what, but that's what we see, about 50 to 60% of people getting into recovery, even though it takes them a little while to do that.
This is Susan Kelly again. Also, there's a statistic that Tom McClellan puts out, which is having to do with people who leave detox and their recovery rate being about 1 or 2% without any further treatment versus the medical profession when a nurse or a doctor is found to have a substance use problem and they participate in the physician's health plan, where they are required to go to meetings and they are followed for 5 years and they have an 80% recovery rate. So I always thought that that was a very interesting comparison and, you know, might point out some of the different, you know, some of the key aspects that help people in their recovery. One is longer-term treatment and longer-term required accountability and
loss of license and
loss of license, yes.
There's a lot at stake in those
motivators, places. Right?
Random therapy.
So, and that seems to be where the whole recovery-oriented systems of care portion of healthcare seems to be trying to fill in with, you know, recovery support specialists who, you know, if people don't get to meetings, they may have a recovery support specialist who is at least calling them all the time to stand in for, you know, not having a sponsor yet or something along those lines. So,
you know,
folks,
we're a little over time, and I'm happy to keep the call going for a little while longer. I don't want to impose on John or other people who may have other things to do. So I don't know, John, are you free to hang on for another 5 minutes? Or
I've got another 5 minutes.
Okay. Anybody else have questions?
I want to ask a little bit about social anxiety. This is a big barrier for people that I have worked with in getting to group self-help groups or treatment groups.
Even online?
Pardon? Yeah, actually, there's been some studies looking at that, showing actually if people can get there, they actually do better, those with social anxiety, than people without.
If they get there.
If they get there, yeah. And there was one study, the Christine Timko stuff published, which was that people with social anxiety did participate as much as those without. And don't forget, you know, the treatment for social anxiety, of course, is exposure to social situations.
Mm-hmm.
And people often, you know, whether they make criteria for a social anxiety disorder or not, often have social anxiety, and they certainly have anxiety early on, just neurophysiologically. They just have heightened excitability and anxiety in the early 6 months after entering recovery. Engaging in groups can actually be what it looks like to be helpful, even though it's slightly counterintuitive.
I have one more question. Going back to Tom Horvath's comment about that there may be common factors in all the support programs, The one thing that struck me here is that is the role of spirituality for the more severely dependent alcoholics, and I wonder if that's something that would really be a real distinction between something like AA and something like SMART.
Well, I think it would be. It could potentially be a distinction. You know, we still may see, you know, in groups like SMART or LifeRing, where spirituality may increase even though it may not be explicitly a part of the program.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could. Of course, it is a part, you know, it's a piece of the kind of, you know, it provides the, you know, the way I think about it is that in 12-step, it provides kind of the overarching storyline. It's the
right.
conceptual storyline that provides coherence to the whole AA story. In CBT oriented groups like SMART, there is the associative learning, the operant and classical conditioning paradigm, which can provide the overarching framework, conceptual framework. But, you know, that will be an interesting test, you know, particularly among the more severe. Is there an added value? I think that's what you're saying, Mark. You know, is there an added value for people with high severity? If you added in a spirituality component, would you actually see a boost in recovery rates based on that?
Yeah, this is Deb Owens,
in Gettysburg. Could I just sort of a question that I have there is with the more severe people, is there any look at their other underlying mental health diagnoses? It would strike me that people who have very high levels of adverse childhood events that make them, you know, and especially really highly damaged attachment relationships and so forth, might be more, you know, needing and helped by deep spiritual reframing of their lives, because it's not merely, as for some outpatients, the issue of social facilitation of, you know, drinking and merely overcoming negative affect. So I guess it's, I'm just wondering if there's any look at the other diagnoses, you know, and the ACEs scores, perhaps, of, you know, people who are coming out of the aftercare, you know, program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they do have higher rates. You're right. They do have higher rates of both, you know, psychiatric distress and other diagnoses, too. And so they are, you know, just have a higher density of, you know, one might say a higher density of psychopathology overall among the more severe addicted folks. And I, you know, I postulated the same thing in terms of, you know, there is a I think, a helpful framework in spiritual ideas that helps to reframe, as you say, reframe stresses or reinterpret stresses. There's also a framework for self-forgiveness. And another theory I have is that with more severe folks, they've done a lot of bad things in blackouts or otherwise, and they may find it hard to forgive themselves for that. And the remorse of that, the burden of guilt and shame and remorse that lingers, the framework may help people to be able to feel like they're forgiven and forgive themselves. And that may actually reduce that stress pathway to relapse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that idea. And I also think that the attachment aspect of it, and having had really terrible things happen to them, and being able to have some sort of transcendent, you know, belief or connection to a higher power, might be, you know, particularly necessary or important for, you know, folks who, you know, have had terrible adverse childhood events.
Right, and
that's
also that if they're able to connecting with other people in 12-step rooms can have that developmental healing effect. They can also run into a lot of people who might not be the most healthy, which hopefully sponsors are guiding them away from. But, yeah, that's something that I've seen in 12-step program processes, just the healing of those developmental breakdowns by having trustful, trustworthy experiences and learning how to set boundaries and things like that in 12-step.
Along those lines, I've been fascinated by this kind of this movement the last couple of years I've been following online. There seems to be a really strong yoga Buddhist community in AA and also this thing called WAFT, which are the agnostics and atheists that have kind of started their own subgroup within AA for people that don't have a traditional belief in a higher power.
Right.
And, you know, just reading their literature and their stories, which are mostly written by people that are sober a long time, but never chose to buy into that part of AA, but nonetheless have, you know, developed healthy lives and are kind of, you know, speaking up about that. It's been kind of fascinating to watch the evolution of that as well and their growth.
And that seems to be typical with people with longer-term sobriety, 10, 20, 30 years plus. It's very, it's not rigid one way. It's it is open to meditation, mindfulness, Buddhist. Well, it is. That's the way the big book is written, the higher power of your understanding. This happens, it's presented in sort of a Christian format, but it is of your understanding, and that's discussed a lot in meetings. But
listen, folks, so. It's quarter after two, so I'm going to, call an end to this. John, thank you so much. That was really great.
Yeah,
thank you very
John.
Much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Hopefully we will touch base with everybody on July 8th when we talk about addiction medicine.
Thank you.
Thank you,
John. Thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.